sermon time. Now we're back with Joseph for another fun-packed, exciting, maybe, episode in his story. Isn't his story a good story? I mean, we love the story of Joseph. It's so simple. I love what Anish brought to us last week, and we'll reference that maybe later. It's not difficult to understand the story of Joseph. Joseph was a man of favor. He was the youngest when he was born of 11 brothers. He had another brother a bit later. But he was the son who had his father's favor. His dad, Jacob, set Joseph above the older 10 sons. He was sold into slavery by his brothers. He had great success wherever he went. He became the man who had the favor of God. In the prison, he had the favor of God, as we've heard in previous weeks. And in Potiphar's house, until Potiphar's wife started doing strange things, he had the favor of his master. He was a man of favor. Everything so far has been about this godly man who, although unwelcome things happened in his life, he always acted with integrity, and it's so positive. But we come to today's chapter, and things change. We're reading today chapter 42, and in a moment Tobias is going to come up and read that for us, and the words will be on the screen behind me, I hope. And it strikes me, there's no activity of God evident in what we read in this chapter. So far, everything's been going really well for Joseph. But now there's an odd chapter. Tobias, please. Tobias? Oh, getting the microphone, sorry. Yeah, blame your dad. He's being slow on the uptake there, isn't he? It's always good to blame your dad, especially when he's not around.
With severe famine everywhere, Joseph opened up the storehouses and distributed grain to the Egyptians. For the famine was severe throughout the land of Egypt, and people from all around came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe throughout the world. When Jacob heard that grain was available in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you standing around looking at one another? I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy enough grain to keep us alive, otherwise we'll die." So Joseph's 10 older brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain. But Jacob wouldn't let Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin, go with them, for fear some harm might come to him. So Jacob's sons arrived in Egypt, along with others, to buy food, for the famine was in Canaan as well. Since Joseph was governor of all of Egypt and in charge of selling grain to all of the people, it was to him that his brothers came. When they arrived, they bowed before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph recognized his brothers instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where are you from?" he demanded. "From the land of Canaan," they replied. "We have come to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him, and he remembered the dreams he had had about them many years before. He said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see how vulnerable our land has become." "No, my lord," they exclaimed. "Your servants have simply come to buy food. We are all brothers, members of the same family. We are honest men, sir. We are not spies." "Yes, you are," Joseph insisted. "You have come to see how vulnerable our land has become." "Sir," they said, "there are actually 12 of us. We, your servants, are all brothers, sons of a living man in the land of Canaan. Our youngest brother is back there with our father right now, and one of our brothers is no longer with us." But Joseph insisted, "As I said, you are spies. This is how I'll test your story. I swear by the life of Pharaoh that you will never leave Egypt unless your younger brother comes here. One of you must go and get your brother. I'll keep the rest of you here in prison. Then we'll find out whether you or not your story is true. By the life of Pharaoh, if it turns out that you do not have a younger brother, then I'll know you are spies." So Joseph put them all in prison for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "I am a God-fearing man. If you do as I say, you will live. If you really are honest men, choose one of your brothers to remain in prison. The rest of you may go home with grain for your starving families. But you must bring your youngest brother back to me. This will prove that you are telling the truth, and you will not die." To this they agreed. Speaking among themselves, they said, "Clearly we are being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life, but we wouldn't listen. That's why we're in this trouble. Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? Reuben asked. But you wouldn't listen, and now we have to answer for his blood. Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them, for they had been speaking through an interpreter. Now he turned away from them and began to weep. When he regained his composure, he spoke to them again. Then he chose Simeon from among the men and tied him up right before their eyes. Joseph then ordered his servants to fill the men's sacks with grain, but he also gave secret instructions to return each brother's payment to the top of the sack. He also gave them supplies for their journey home, so the brothers loaded their donkeys with the grain and headed for home. But when they stopped for the night and one of them opened his sack to get grain for his donkey, he found his money in the top of the sack. Look, he exclaimed to his brothers, my money has been returned, it's here in my sack. Then their hearts sank, trembling, they said to each other, what has God done to us? When the brothers came to their father, Jacob, in the land of Canaan, they told him everything that had happened to them. The man who was governor of the land spoke very harshly to us, they told him. He accused us of being spies scouting the land, but we said, we are honest men, not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of one father. One brother is no longer with us, and the youngest is at home with our father in the land of Canaan. Then the man who was governor of the land told us, this is how I will find if you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take grain for your starving families and go on home. But you must bring your youngest brother back to me. Then I will know if you are honest men and not spies. Then I will give you back your brother and you may treat freely in the land. As they emptied out their sacks, there in each man's sack was the bag of money he paid for the grain. The brothers and their father were terrified when they saw the bags of money. Jacob exclaimed, you're robbing me of my children. Joseph is gone, Simeon is gone, and now you want to take Benjamin too. Everything is going against me. Then Reuben said to his father, you may kill two of my sons if I don't bring Benjamin back to you. I'll be responsible for him, and I promise to bring him back. But Jacob replied, my son will not go down with you. His brother Joseph is dead, and he is all I have left. If anything should happen to him on your journey, you would send this grieving, white-haired man to his grave.
Thank you very much, Tobias. Well read. That's a long passage, isn't it? But it's actually, I think, we need to see all of it. There's a lot to pick up on there, but I want to pick up on just one warning, one encouragement, and one question for us today. One warning, one encouragement, and one question. I'd like you to cast your minds back, those of you who go that far back, there aren't that many perhaps, to a nice, warm, dry, sunny August day in 1982. I walked into a rose garden just outside of Belfast with my girlfriend, and I walked out with my fiance. Isn't that nice? And I was full of joy. A year later, I saw my fiance walk into a church, and she walked out with me, my beautiful, wonderful wife, Barbara. Happy, happy, happy days. 6 years later, I went to visit her in hospital. We'd been wanting to start a family for several years. We were expecting. We had a miscarriage. Devastating, intense sadness, floods of tears. A year later, and then 3 years after that, absolute joy when our two sons were born. Perhaps you don't associate with those things yet. How about this? Watching a film. How many have seen the film Good Night, Mr. Tom? If you haven't, get a box of tissues and watch it. Because honestly, I can't watch that film, and I've watched it several times, without a handkerchief. Maybe you've watched Ghost, that wonderful film with the song Unchained Melody. If you've not seen it, it's not a very theological film, but it's for me a big, big weepy. Those films tug at my heartstrings and they stir emotions within me. My British stiff upper lip control center in my brain hits my lacrimal glands. That means where my tears come from. And the tears stream. I get throttled in my eyes. Over many years, on numerous occasions, in this church and other churches, my eyes are again, perhaps more than just a little bit moist, because when God's moving, when I see God touching the hearts, the lives of other people, it stirs deep, deep joy and delight within my soul that comes rushing out. Emotions can be wonderful. They can be, and often are, something of a roller coaster. Emotions can be deep, they can be profound, they can be intense. They can be what we deem to be positive, happy, joyful. They can at other times distract us. And sometimes emotions weigh us down and we feel like we can't move, like our feet are made of lead or stuck in a pool of treacle and we can't move forwards because our emotions confuse and hold us back. Why do I tell you all this? Well, quite simply, because when I read Genesis 42, I used to read it as, oh, this is what happened to Joseph. It's part of the Bible. That's good. No, now I read chapter 42 as being a big episode of emotions. There are lots of emotions here. Joseph has already, as I've said, come through many changes, which must have caused him joy and stress and emotional turmoil. There was pride when his father chose him over his sons to inherit his promise. There was pride in being given that very elaborate coat. There was confusion when his own brothers, threw him into a pit and sold him into slavery. There was pain and anguish as he entered slavery, fear not knowing what his future held. There was confusion and suffering when his master's wife, as we've already mentioned, Potiphar's wife, falsely accused him and then Potiphar got rid of him. The thrill of being used by God to interpret the dreams of two fellow prisoners. Who here doesn't like knowing that God is using you, using what you're saying, using what you're doing, using whatever to bless someone else? It's a thrill. The distress when one interpretation was followed by an execution, that of the chief baker. But the delight that the other interpretation for the chief cupbearer came to be, and he was restored to his elevated position. But then disappointment. I gave that word and he's been promoted back to chief cupbearer for Pharaoh. And I'm stuck in prison. Why did I bother doing it? But then joy, perhaps, when at last he's remembered. Anticipation, perhaps mixed with fear and trembling, when he's called to go before Pharaoh. Astonishment when Pharaoh asks this man, a prisoner, to interpret his dream. But then a rising sense of boldness, and this is perhaps the only bit of that story of Joseph. No, sorry, that's previous to chapter 42. It's boldness that he can stand before Pharaoh and say, I can't do that, Pharaoh. But God can. Finally, the elation of being promoted to the position of governor, an unimaginably high office, equivalent to our prime minister. How would you feel if Terry Berger came to you and said, I'd like you to come and serve on my team? Unimaginable, but it was greater even for Joseph. But let's not forget Joseph's brothers and father. In this story, we also read of fear of starvation. The brothers fear as they were falsely accused by Joseph, Pharaoh's man. Confusion and anguish as the brothers were put into prison. They didn't know it was just going to be for 3 days. They thought only one of us is going home to our father. The rest of us might rot here forever. More confusion and fear when 9 of them are sent on their way with their grain and they then find their money back in their bags. What's happening? What's happening? Is this going to get us in trouble? What's happening? I don't understand what's happening. And then the brothers have a sense of rejection. They return to their father. And they say to their father, look, we've left one in prison. And that man says, unless Benjamin, our brother, comes, then he stays there and we can't get any more grain. What does the father say? What does Jacob say to the brothers? He is all I have left. What does that say to them of their father's love, their father's appreciation? The 10 brothers count as nothing beside Benjamin, the youngest brother. Lots of emotions. Let's just go back a step, though, to Joseph. When the 10 brothers come to see Joseph, they don't know it's Joseph. It's the governor. He's the man in charge of the grain. In verse 6, they come to him. They don't recognize him. He does not reveal himself to them. Separated for at least 20 years. I'm just thinking my father had a separation from his brother for, I don't know how many years it was. It was probably 5, 10, maybe 15 or more. And I remember my dad saying to me, when he met his brother again after there'd been some sort of rift, his brother just carried on talking as if they'd just finished a conversation a couple of minutes before. But here, Joseph doesn't acknowledge them as his brothers. But what comes into Joseph's mind? Can I suggest memories? If you've not seen somebody for 20 years, if you've not seen somebody in your family for 20 years, you've been separate, and then you see them, what's going to come back to you? Memories. Not just the memories of being despised by the brothers. Not just the memories of being sold into slavery. Not just the memories of being falsely accused by his boss's wife. Not just the memories of living in prison for some years. Not just the memories of missing his dad. Joseph could no longer escape those memories. And as he thought and remembered his cherished, beloved father. When I was preparing this, I had to stop and think. To a separation from his father. He pretends that he doesn't recognize his brothers. That's deception. It's vile, vile deception. It was born out of intense bitterness. They did that to me. I'm not going to welcome them warmly. I'm just going to blank them. Retribution. The decision is made. Unforgiveness and vindictiveness will rule his heart. Now do you see why chapter 42 is so totally different from what's gone on before? Because the choices that Joseph makes are not the choices that he should make. And oh, how simple it would be if the brothers came before him and he stood there with arms open wide and he said, "Brothers, me, Joseph, come here, give me a hug." Wouldn't that have been a lovely story? But that's not what he does. His response is born out of unforgiveness and bitterness. That seed of bitterness lying dormant in Joseph's heart for years has now, in an instant, been watered, ingrained, and sprouted. The root of bitterness has burst forth, and it burrows deeply into his soul. He knows that he has dealt himself a mortal wound, one from which he might not recover. We read in verse 24, he turned away from them, his brothers, and he wept. He didn't weep because he's seen his brothers. That should be a source of joy. He wept because his response to them was one of bitterness, unforgiveness, holding them back. He knows he's done wrong. But even now, he doesn't turn around and say, "Brothers, forgive me. It's me. It really is me, your brother Joseph. Come here, give me a hug." He doesn't do that. His entire being is racked with grief, torn by negative emotions. This self-inflicted wound, the emotions that rise from within, turn and come back as a dagger, piercing his heart again and again and again. Hear the words of Jesus in Matthew's gospel. If you want to turn to it, do, but I won't give you much time. Chapter 5, verse 44 and 45. "I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you." The German Christian martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes of this verse, "By our enemies, Jesus means those who are quite difficult or stubborn and utterly unresponsive to our love, who forgive us nothing when we forgive them, who respond to our love with hatred and to our service for them with mockery or ridicule. The enemies are those who refuse the offer of love and remain stubbornly opposed to the one offering that love." So I said, there was one warning, one encouragement, and one question for us this morning. The warning is this. We know Joseph's story. The warning is this. Just because God has used us in the past does not mean that we're not going to mess up in the future. It's a warning for all church leaders and all church members and everyone else. Just because God's done stuff through me in the past doesn't mean that I've suddenly become a great saintly character who can hover over the land and walk on water and never do any wrong. I am going to foul up again and again and again, but I know God loves me and will forgive me. That's the warning. The encouragement, God knows all things. God knew what Joseph was going to do in chapter 42, although in Joseph's day it wasn't called chapter 42, it was just one bit of his life. God knew what Joseph was going to do, yet still he chose to use him. What that encouragement is for me is even though I know God knows all about me, and I don't want you to know all about me, I really don't, but God knows all about me, and he can still choose to use me, and he can still choose to use you. So if you reflect on yourself and think, I fouled up there, I messed up here, I did that then, I did that there, God still chooses to use you and me to do good and to minister both to him and to each other. And the question is this: how do we respond when we are hurt, when we're upset, when someone does something or says something or doesn't do something or doesn't say anything and it causes us hurt, emotional turmoil? Joseph had a choice. He responded, he chose to respond to what his brothers had done. After all, they despised, they rejected him. He owed them nothing. We can choose to respond when something happens to the person and to what they've done. We can choose to operate on the level of law. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And what does that lead to? A world full of blind people groping around trying to find soup to eat. That's not a world I want to live in. There is another option. We could respond as Jesus would. I love that phrase, what would Jesus do? It's simple. What did Jesus do when he was despised and rejected? He gave his life. He didn't justify himself. The only people he ever criticized were those who thought that they were good, they were holy, they kept all the law. He didn't criticize the wounded, the hurting. He gave them his hand. He gave them his heart. He gave them his life. He lifted them. Brothers and sisters, I suggest that's how we should respond. Not by looking at circumstance, situation, but when we're hurt, when we're upset, when something happens, when we think we've been overlooked, when this has happened and that and happened, the others happen. What's that old song say? One of the first songs I ever learned in the church, in a youth group, 5 years before I got saved. So we're going back a long, long time. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace, his lavish, lavish grace sent upon us. I'm going to cut out most of what I've got here now, but because there's so much. But Proverbs 14, 26, 27 in the NIV says, whoever fears the Lord has a secure fortress, and for their children it will be a refuge. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, turning a person from the snares of death. God is a fortress and a fountain because evil attacks us and attracts us. We need the fortress, but the fountain that is God is a well of joy and love and grace. And then one final thought here. I don't know how you're feeling and thinking, oh, Chris, I wish you hadn't preached this morning. This is getting so down. But this is, look, Joseph's story is a story of a man through his life. It is not a set of theological instructions that we must learn from. We look at his life, and he got hurt. And I'm not going to tell you what happens in 43 and following, because I don't want to steal anyone else's thunder. But Psalm 147, he, the Lord our God, heals the broken-hearted and bandages their wounds. So I'll leave you with that we turn to our fortress and our fountain. It doesn't mean the problems disappear, but we get them in perspective. And it's better to tackle those issues that we face holding Father's hand, knowing that he goes before us, he walks beside us, and he's behind us. And we see one step at a time. I don't see where I'm going to be many steps down the line. But we walk with God in all these things and allow him to minister to our hearts before he bandages our wounds. So when difficulties come along, when struggles come along, we find in our fortress our fountain.